If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Wednesday, August the 14th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution. My guest today here in our recording studio on the campus of Stanford University is Edward Lazier. Edward P. Lazier is the Morris Arnold and Nona Jean Cox Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution and the Davies Family Professor of Economics at Stanford University's Graduate School of Business. From 2006 to 2009 in the Bush 43 White House, he was chairman of the President's Council of Economic Advisors. Before coming to Stanford, Ed Lazier taught at the University of Chicago. He is a familiar name to those of you who read the pages of the Wall Street Journal, where his fine commentaries appear periodically, or if you watch CNBC or Fox Business Channel, where he is on air talking about the economy. And that is indeed our topic today, the state of the American economy. Eddie, thanks for doing the podcast.
Pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
So you literally came down from high altitude to do this. You spend your time in Lake Tahoe. Why do you choose to live at high altitude, just out of curiosity?
Well, I'm a California native. I've actually spent much of my life here, and I'm happy to be here. We actually moved up there just for personal reasons. My daughter happens to live up there. We bought what we thought would be a vacation home and ended up liking living in the mountains so much that we kind of relocated. So I'm full-time at Stanford. I'm a commuter. I come in during the week, almost every week, and then go back on the weekends and get to ski and mountain bike. So not a bad life.
That sounds like a rough life.
Yeah.
Before we get into the economy, let's do a point of clarification. I mentioned that you chaired the CEA in the Bush White House.
Right.
Those who are listening to the podcast, they might understand what a speechwriter does. They might understand what a chief of staff does or a press secretary. Explain briefly what the chairman of the CEA does. You are the 24th CEA, or our colleague Michael Boskin was the 15th. What does that job entail exactly?
The Council of Economic Advisors is actually the sort of the internal consulting agency for the president. So the president has a lot of technical issues that he has to think about. The Council of Economic Advisors is probably the least political agency within the executive office of the president, in that it was our job to give essentially technical advice about how the economy is doing, what's going on. Mm-hmm. So interpreting numbers, giving policy statements on things that the president might want to know about. But again, not so much from a political point of view. In fact, one of the things that I was told when I came into that office specifically was, don't be political, stick to your knitting, talk about the economics. The president and his more political people can advise him on the politics of things. That's not your job. Your job is to talk about the reality, the facts, the numbers, what the theory tells you what we should be doing. Not necessarily whether it's practical, but just what is the best thing to do, and leave it to him to decide whether it's appropriate or not.
So let me throw a hypothetical at you. You're sitting in the Trump White House come January, February of next year, and the president's speechwriter approaches you and says, Dr. Lazier, I'm writing the president's State of the Union address, and we're going to throw in the obligatory line of the state of the economy is strong. Speechwriters always choose the word strong. I guess it's the best word available. What is your professional advice, though? Is strong appropriate in this economy, keeping in mind that today we're talking while the market is having a very bad day. Yesterday it had a very good day. It's in a period of fluctuation right now.
The economy, it has been strong over the past couple of years, so it depends on the president's time horizon. As you mentioned, things are volatile. Growth rates tend to move up and down. If you look at the growth in 2017 and 2018 as compared with the growth in 2015 and 2016, mm-hmm. President Trump will take credit, in part justifiably, for the increase in growth that we've seen in the economy over the past couple of years. And if I were in his shoes, that's what I would be focusing on. I'd basically be saying that if you look at the last 3 years of the economy and you compare that to the Obama administration,
right,
it is stronger. Whether he's responsible for it or not is another issue and a more mm-hmm. difficult issue to to resolve. But in terms of the actual numbers, there's no doubt that the numbers have been better during the past 2.5-3 years than they were during the Obama term.
Right. Now, politically, a president will obviously compare his economy versus his predecessors, especially if the economy is doing better. But how does the American economy, Eddie, compare versus other G7 countries?
Well, that's a really that's a good question. And in fact, the nice thing that, and of course, President Trump has talked about this, but this is not specific to President Trump. Even during President Obama's term, which was a period during which we actually had a relatively weak recovery. Even that weak recovery still placed us above our G7 counterparts. So while we were growing at, say, 2%, most of the other countries were growing in the 1% range. So the U.S. has actually done very well. And there are actually a number of indicators, kind of ironic, actually. If you think about the financial crisis, which most attributed to the financial markets here and argued that it started here, although even that, I think, is not so uncontroversial in the sense that there are different factors in other countries. But let's put that aside for a moment and assume that it did start here. The irony was when the financial crisis hit, all the money flowed to the United States. So, you know, treasuries, the rates on treasuries just crashed, fell to zero because why? Because everybody wanted to put their money in the United States. Why? Because the United States was a safe haven. So even during that period, when we were in theory the epicenter of the financial crisis, we were also the epicenter of safety in terms of places that people wanted to hold their investment funds.
Right. So I imagine when you give speeches, the question always comes up is, where is this economy going? Will it be strong a year from now when we're in the middle of a presidential race? And you look at the market as the indicator, correct?
I do. And let me give you a couple of reasons for that. One is essentially just an empirical statement, and the other is a conceptual statement. Let me start with the conceptual first. So the conceptual is simply this. If you think about what the market is doing, there are lots of indicators of how an economy is growing. You can look at the job market. You can look at unemployment rates. You can look at past GDP. You can look at oil prices. You can look at treasury rates. Lots and lots of indicators. The market is looking at all of those. So what the market is essentially doing is it's processing all these numbers and giving them appropriate weights. And the reason I say appropriate is that people are kind of betting with their money. So they're putting their money where their mouths are. And so some of the things are more important indicators and some of the things are less important indicators. That's the conceptual reason. There's one other aspect of the conceptual side, and that is that the market is forward-looking as opposed to backward-looking. So I'll give you an example. If you looked at the market in right around the time that the financial crisis was picking up steam, and that would actually be not in the summer of 2008, but actually December, January of 2007, which we were already headed into a recession at that point. The market saw that, but if you looked at the GDP numbers, you wouldn't actually see that because we were peaking. We weren't on the way down yet. So the point was that the market was observing things that you wouldn't see in the past GDP numbers, and it's for that reason that you want to rely on the market. Now, I said that's the conceptual side. That's the logical reason for why you'd think about it that way.
Right.
The empirical side is simply that it's the best indicator. So if you just do an analysis and you say, I have to pick one. I have to pick one thing that's going to best predict growth rates, say, over the next 4 quarters. Just as a factual matter, looking back historically, it turns out that the change in the S&P 500 either over the last 3 months or over the last 6 months is your best indicator.
Right.
That's the best predictor. Just one more point on that, Bill, and then I'll pause for a second. When I say best, I want you to realize that best doesn't mean good. And the reason best doesn't mean good is that forecasting is a very nasty business. We're not very good at it. Everybody always asks economists, you know, what's going to happen in the future. It's really one of our worst skills, not one of our best. But if I say, you know, right now the market is forecasting about 1.5% growth for next year, that's still plus or minus 1 percentage point. So it could be 2.5, it could be 0.5.
economic forecasting is a little bit like hurricane forecasting, isn't it? You have models, you have thoughts of where storms can track, but you don't know until the storm actually arrives what happens.
That's right, and that's actually, I think that's a good analogy, because if you think about a hurricane, we know that the conditions look like we're going to get a hurricane. We can't tell exactly where it's going to track. We don't know if it's going to be a Category 4, whether it's going to be a Category 2, until we get close to the time. Right. And that's the same thing with the economy.
There was an immigration raid in the Deep South last week. It was either Mississippi or Alabama. Forgive me for not having the right state, but I watched it on the news, and I remember the commentator on the news saying, well, those jobs could be back for you easily because the state has a high unemployment rate. And I looked it up, Eddie. It's a 5% unemployment rate. It's either Mississippi or Alabama, mm-hmm. but their unemployment rate is 5%. That's what passes for high unemployment these days in the United States. I mention that because the Labor Department came out with some numbers on jobs for the month of June. And here's what the Labor Department reported. It said the U.S. economy had 7.4 million job openings in June, but only 6 million people were looking for work. Right. This is 16 straight months now that the number of open jobs has been higher than the number of people looking for work in the United States of America. You're a labor economist. Is this unprecedented in American history that the demand outweighs the supply?
It is not unprecedented, but it is a very strong labor market. It's probably as strong or stronger than any labor market I have seen in my entire professional career. So the market is hot, and there are a couple of indicators of that. The first one actually tells us that we're not yet at the peak, and that may sound a little bit surprising because unemployment rates are so low, job openings are so high relative to the number of people applying, and you'd say, boy, it sure sounds like we're at the peak. This sure looks like full employment. Mm-hmm. And yet the best indicator that we're not quite there, we're getting there, but the best indicator that we're not quite there is that job growth still exceeds the number of jobs necessary to keep up with a growing population. So to put that in simple English, if you thought about what would happen at the peak, if we were just in stable, full employment equilibrium, what would happen? Well, every month you'd have to have enough jobs created to keep up with the new people coming into the labor force. Mm-hmm. If you have more jobs created than the number of people coming into the labor force, what that tells you is that you're still making up for lost ground. You're still expanding. That tells you you're still in the recovery phase. And if you look at job growth, we're still in numbers like 150 to 170,000 a month. An amount we need to keep up with growing population is around 80 or 90,000. So we're still well above that. Now, there's one other piece of good news, and that is that wage growth has picked up. So when you're at the top of a job market, what you tend to see is that wages start to grow because there is excess demand, just as you said. The only way employers can fill their slots is to make sure that they pay higher wages. That's a good thing for workers. That's happening now. But it's happening at a rate that is commensurate with what you'd see close to the top of the job market, and that is that the rate of growth of wages is equal to productivity plus inflation. Now, why do I say that? Well, in the long run, essentially the only way that you can grow wages is you have to have workers becoming more productive. Firms can't simply decide to pay workers more. They have to justify that payment with additional output, additional productivity, additional sales. So what you need essentially is for wages to grow at the rate of productivity, but of course you want that to be true in real terms, not just in terms of the actual dollars. And in order to put that in real terms, you have to correct for inflation. So what's inflation right now? Well, a little under 2%. What's productivity right now? A little over 1.5%. So add those two together and you're talking about the mid-3 range, and that's exactly where we are in terms of wage growth. So we're dead on where we should be in a full employment economy.
As you're an economist, but I'm a recovering speechwriter, I'll tell you what the president will say next year when he's on the campaign trail. He'll talk about good jobs at good paying wages, and his Democratic opponent to be named later, Eddie, will say, Mr. President, with all due respect, those are Mick jobs.
Yeah, well, usually what people are talking about are service jobs as opposed to manufacturing jobs, and that's disparaging of service jobs because service jobs are actually not bad jobs. In fact, our economy, like all modern developed economies are primarily service economies. So if you think about the U.S. economy, it's about 80% services. Mm-hmm. But there are very high-paying service jobs as well. In fact, you and I have a couple of them right now. If you think about professional individuals, physicians, engineers, lawyers, professors like us, who have graduate degrees, we earn high salaries. Those are still service jobs. There are lower-level service jobs that are also high-paying. For example, in the health industry, if you think of people, professionals like nurses, for example, those are relatively high-paying jobs. People in the tech industry, we live in Silicon Valley, obviously, again, the center of the tech industry in terms of both growth and creativity, but also the center in terms of talent. If you think about where the most talented tech people are in the country, they're here. They're doing service jobs. They're not manufacturing. They're doing service jobs. So there's nothing wrong with service jobs. That's fine, but we like them to be high-paying service jobs. How do they get to be high-paying? Again, I go back to what we talked about before. It's all about productivity.
I just double-checked to make sure my iPhone is turned off, so this would seem like a good moment to talk about China. China in the news constantly, it seems, this week in the news. The president delays tariffs until December the 15th. This would have been 10% tariffs on smartphones, laptops, toys, video games, and other products. I think Christmas came early to the White House this year. He's looking at the Christmas economy. You follow trade. You follow China. Let's talk a bit about the impact of what's going on with China. Can we really kind of do what's going on right now, or should we perhaps wait in a few days until Walmart comes out with earnings? What's your take on what's happened so far?
China is important to us, but it's not quite as important as I think the popular press makes it out to be. Mm-hmm. And let me be clear on this. When people think about the impact of another country on our economy, first order, by far the most important aspect of that is their demand for our goods and services. So mm-hmm. The question is, what proportion of our GDP do we export to China? That's going to give you the best indicator of how important China is to us. Answer is that's less than 1% of our GDP.
Right.
So even if that fell to zero, which of course it won't do, but even mm-hmm. if that were to fall to zero, what that would mean would be, 3-4 months worth of growth for the United States right now at current mm-hmm. growth rates. Obviously, it's not something we would want, but it's not a disaster. Now, if you turn that around and you ask, well, are we in the driver's seat with respect to China? Because, of course, President Trump thinks we are and has been making that pitch for a couple of years now. They need us more than we need them. It is true that they need us more than we need them, but they don't need us quite as much as we think they do, or at least as the rhetoric would allow. If you look at how important we are to China, we're about 4 to 4.5% of their GDP. So again, 4 times as large as they are to us, we're 4 times important to them as they are to us, but still 4% of GDP, even if they lost all of that, would put them back, again, about 2/3 of a year in terms of their growth at 6%. So not something they would welcome. Those are the direct effects. Now, let me just mention one thing before I give you back the mic here. And that is that there are very significant indirect effects that we worry about as well. They tend not to be as large as direct effects, but the indirect effects are important as well. Those generally have to do with investment uncertainty. So if you think about the kind of volatility that we've seen in markets, if you think about what's going on in terms of the political volatility with respect to China, North Korea, and mm-hmm. of course Iran, which is a much less important player in terms of the actual trade situation, if you look at what's going on there, investors worry about uncertainty primarily because they have to make investment decisions and they want to hold off until they know what's going on before they make long-term decisions. So those indirect effects are important, as are, of course, the national security implications.
If you are the government of Beijing, Eddie, and you want to hurt the U.S. economy, if you want to send a message to Trump, how do you do it? Do you make veiled threats and thus spook the stock market? Do you actually start withholding products? What is your approach to messing up this economy?
Well, I think actually they've done a pretty good job. The one thing we fear from China, again, is capriciousness, uncertainty, volatility, not in terms of markets, but volatility in terms of their policies. Mm-hmm. And if you look at what's derailed the trade talks over the past year or so, it really has been volatility in their policy. That's been President Trump's complaint.
Right.
But I think there is something to that. Obviously, the president always wants to blame the other side when things aren't going well in negotiations. But I think his accusations are well-founded in the sense that the Chinese have been a bit erratic. I think it's strategically erratic. I think what they've done is they've pushed as far as they can, and then when they see that's not working, they back off. That has been an effective policy in terms of getting us to move. You mentioned just a couple of minutes ago mm-hmm. that the president decided to put off the tariffs to December.
Yes.
He was going to bring them in September. Now, you know, got another 3 month reprieve. That looks like a pretty effective policy.
Okay. The Trump administration last week labeled China a currency manipulator. This is an unusual move by an administration. I did a little homework. The Clinton administration did it in the 1990s. We are of a different age, by the way. I remember, first of all, it was a big deal when Nixon went to China. I was a young boy at the time, but it was big news. I remember in the 92 campaign, I think it was, Eddie, when China and MFN status was a big debate between Bush 41 and Bill Clinton.
Right.
But here we are now where China is now officially, quote, a currency manipulator. This comes on the heels of the People's Bank of China allowing its currency to fall below 7 yuan to the U.S. dollar. Does Donald Trump have an argument here?
He does. In fact, there is almost no doubt that China is a currency manipulator. The question is it pernicious? Does it have adverse consequences for us? Now, when I say...
Before we get into that, Eddie, let's clarify for the audience. For years, China has been on the Treasury Department list of bad guys when it comes to currency. What is the difference between being on the bad guy list and being officially labeled as a currency manipulator?
Well, when you're labeled a currency manipulator, there are actions that the U.S. government can take that are retaliatory in terms of tariff policies, aspects of non-tariff barriers, other things that we allow ourselves to do when we've labeled someone a currency manipulator that would otherwise be a violation of the World Trade Organization kind of statutes. So we essentially say we're not going to follow those because these guys are currency manipulators. So that's the reason for doing it. Now, let me just come back to the politics of this before I give you the economics of it, because you mentioned an important thing. You said that, you know, it's something that's been resisted. The last time we did it was during the Clinton administration.
Right.
And when I was in the government, I mean, this came up every year. There was no question that they were manipulating the currency. Up until 2005, they held it constant at a little over 8 to a dollar. Mm-hmm. Well, to hold it constant, you've got to manipulate your currency. There's no way to peg a currency without manipulating.
Right.
So by definition, you're manipulating. Treasury has a slightly different definition of what they mean by manipulator. Mm-hmm. But in some sense, those are details. The issue that governments have had to deal with is whether they want to label a country a currency manipulator and then say you're a bad guy and impose these sanctions on you. Congress always wants to do it. By the way, it's actually been primarily the Dems, not the Republicans, that have been pushing this. Chuck Schumer has been one of the strongest advocates for labeling China a currency manipulator over time, was even when I was in the White House.
Yes.
It's usually the executive branch that has to behave like adults in this situation and try to resist the political and populist pressure to label a country a manipulator. And in fact, they have done that. And in fact, even President Trump has done that, despite his obvious hostility to Chinese practices in terms of the economy. So this is, as you say, I wouldn't say it's quite unprecedented, but it's certainly unusual and something that it needs to be followed over the
Now, the economic side, does this have any real impact on trade?
Well, so here's the issue. The question is, do exchange rates affect trade? And of course, everybody would say, well, it's obvious that exchange rates affect trade. I mean, if you make things cheaper, people are going to buy more goods and services. Mm-hmm. As it turns out, as an empirical matter, that's just not true. Now, when I say it's not true, it is true a little bit, but it's not very much true. The easiest way to see this, and I apologize to your listeners because this is going to be sort of a technical argument, but it's an important technical argument. If you look at the rate, the exchange rates between the yuan and the euro, they're very different from the exchange rates between the yuan and the U.S. dollar. Why is that? Well, just think about it for a second. If the yuan is pegged pretty closely to the U.S. dollar, but the U.S. dollar floats relative to the euro, then that means that the yuan, which is pegged to the U.S. dollar, is also going to float relative to the euro. So what that would imply is if exchange rates have a big effect on trade, what one should expect is that exports from China to the European Union should look very different than exports from China to the United States because the exchange rates are so different across those two regions. Mm-hmm. And if you look at that, I don't have a chart, obviously I can't show you that right now, but if you look at that, you would be amazed because the pattern of trade from China to the EU looks almost identical to the pattern of trade from China to the United States. What that tells you is that essentially producers absorb the costs, other things equilibrate to offset some of those exchange rate movements. Now, this is turns out this is well known. This is not a new idea. This is not a new fact. People who have studied the economics of trade between countries have found that the most important determinant of trade patterns is actually the income of the importing country, the productivity of the exporting country, the location, of course, of those countries. So we trade with Mexico and Canada because they're our closest neighbors. And then finally, the last of those four factors is the exchange rate. So it's not that it doesn't matter, but it only matters a little bit relative to the other components.
Thank you for bringing up Mexico. I'd like to get in that for a minute. Let's deviate for a second off the economy. I sat at a Hoover conference years and years ago where you gave a talk about immigration. And Dr. Edward Lazier had a plan to fix immigration. Briefly tell me what the plan was, and are you thinking about trotting it out again? Because the president was talking about immigration the other day, and it sounds like he is starting to move toward your position in terms of recognizing people who come to the country ready to participate in the economy.
He is. Actually, it's quite interesting. I mean, we don't want to make this too time sensitive, but the Wall Street Journal just had an editorial on this piece exactly today, and they were kind of blasting his plan because they thought it was a way to shut down immigration. Whether it will be used in that way or not, I think it remains to be seen. But I think that the point that is, at least to the extent that there's something good in that plan, what the president seems to be trying to do is to rationalize our immigration system. As you probably recall, again, when I was in the White House, this was back in 2007, President Bush, a pro-immigration Republican, paired up with the late Senator Ted Kennedy, tried to put through a comprehensive immigration reform bill. So you had someone from the left, someone from the right, drafted what we thought was a pretty good piece of legislation, just didn't get over the hump. Right. So I think many of the components of that were good ideas. The main thing in that plan in terms of legal immigration was trying to rationalize our system by bringing in people who would be most valuable to the United States. Now, when I say most valuable, that doesn't necessarily mean that we wouldn't let relatives in. Obviously, we would give credit to people who had family in the United States, but we would also take occupation into account to a greater extent. So, for example, if there are jobs that are going open, you mentioned a few minutes ago, you mentioned that there, you know, unemployment, that the number of job openings exceeds the number of people available. That's not true in all occupations. It's more true in some than in others. What we ought to be doing is taking in immigrants who will fill those occupations, and that would be a way to rationalize the system. The second problem that we have, of course, is the situation with people who are currently here undocumented way, illegal, whichever word you choose to use. They are here and in a kind of a purgatory status. And the question is, what do we do about those individuals? We have probably 11 million or so, as estimated by Pew Foundation and others. That's a lot of people. We're not going to have those people go home. That's just unrealistic. And so the question is, what do we do? What I would propose that we do is issue something that I would call a Z visa. So a Z visa would be a visa that you would give to people who could document that they were here for X number of years. X might be 3, might be 5, have no criminal record. And we'd say, all right, you're here. We're going to allow you to stay here, but you came in an unlawful way, and there's a penalty associated with that. The penalty is essentially a payment that you have to give to the government each year for the Z visa. Might be a couple hundred dollars a year, And you can then go to the end of the line and apply for a green card just as if you were in your native country. We're not going to hold that against you, but then you can become a productive member of society. You have no uncertainty. You can invest. It's kind of a compromise solution. It's a fine. It's not draconian. You don't send people home, but you also don't give them complete amnesty. So it's kind of a middle-of-the-road solution.
What about an HK visa, Eddie, for those investors and entrepreneurs in Hong Kong who might be thinking that it might be better for their longevity to be living in the United States now?
Well, that's a good idea. And, of course, other countries have done that, Canada being the most obvious example, and they've brought in some very high income and highly talented people into their economy. That's been a good thing for them. I think we could do some of that as well. I would have that actually work through, again, not so much the visa system. I would think of that as being part of the regular green card citizenship system that we had, and it would just be that they would get more points in that system, get more credit for being entrepreneurs. So that would be a way to integrate that into the system in a more direct way.
You could see this president very publicly poking China in the eye by saying to residents of Hong Kong, come to America, you're welcome here.
Yeah, I think it would. He'd have to be careful about doing that. I would not do it specifically with respect.
Donald Trump, careful.
Well, yeah. Well, what, even well, even more careful than that. I wouldn't want to pick a particular country and say that we're going to give this to Hong Kong. Obviously, we have asylum. That's obviously a controversial issue right now. Mm-hmm. Political refugees. If people from Hong Kong were coming in for political reasons, for asylum reasons, they would come in under that. Right. I think what you're suggesting, though, is something other than that. You're suggesting people who are entrepreneurial and can contribute to the U.S. economy be given some additional credit in terms of their application. I think that's a great idea, but again, I wouldn't make it specific to Hong Kong. If someone is coming from Bosnia, for example, but they're entrepreneurial and they fit the criterion, I'd give them the same points as I would give
So I remember correctly, the ZIR plan included actually having to pay make a down payment to come to the United States.
Well, that was a slightly different plan than the one I'm talking about right now. That's a sort of a more dramatic kind of plan. I think it's a good plan in terms of offering people the ability to come in if they were willing to pay to come in, because it essentially says you get the people who value citizenship the most. Now, the thing that people always worry about with that is that, you know, would we only get rich people? What about people that we would like to have, the tired and poor that are on the Statue of Liberty? The way I would actually do that is I would say we would finance that over time for these individuals. So they wouldn't have to pay it up front. It would be something, again, like a $200 a year kind of payment that they would make. But that's, that's a more dramatic, kind of more radical plan. I don't think that stands much of a prayer. I'd love to see something like that happen. I don't think it's going to happen. What I was suggesting before is simply to allocate our slots in a way that makes more sense, perhaps giving a higher proportion on the basis of occupation and needs rather than on other kinds of criteria.
Okay, let's talk about Trump and Mexico now. Presidents can offer carrots, presidents can offer sticks to countries. Donald Trump, in a Rooseveltian way and a non-Rooseveltian way at the same time, Teddy, not Franklin, does not speak softly, but with regard to Mexico, he at all times is swinging a big stick. The other day, for example, the White House announced that it's going to give Mexico a year to prove that it's doing something to combat the drug trade. If not, the U.S. government could withhold financial assistance to Mexico, block international development bank loans. That's a stick, not a carrot.
That's right.
But it appears, though, that he has the Mexican's government, he has the government of Mexico's attention. They're listening to him, and they actually want to work with him.
The government of Mexico has no choice but to listen to him. Go back to the discussion we had about China and China trade and what would happen if we cut off trade with China or they cut off trade with us. I mentioned a number like 1% of GDP in terms of our exports to them, 4.5% of GDP, their exports to us. If you look at Mexico, it's a completely different story. Obviously, this wouldn't happen, but if Mexico lost its ability to export to the United States, it would cost them about a third of their GDP. That would almost surely result in major chaos within the country, probably political upheaval and everything else that you can possibly think of. Right. And the president of Mexico is clearly aware of that. So when Trump is negotiating with Mexico, or Canada, actually, for that matter, same, pretty much the same situation with Canada, he has an enormous stick because while they are, both of those countries are our major trading partners, we view them as extremely important. Again, we are way more important to them than they are to us. And so the asymmetry there is much greater than the asymmetry with respect to China.
Okay. Let's move forward now. Looking further out in time, how do we keep the economy growing?
All right. Well, that's
simple question all the time. You have 30 seconds.
the simple answer is productivity. And we can talk about how we get productivity to grow in a minute. But the simple answer is productivity. The reason is this. We know that the demographics are moving against us.
Right.
So not as bad in this country, by the way, as in other countries. If you look at Italy, Japan, Germany, China in particular, have much more adverse demographic characteristics over the long haul than we do.
Mm-hmm.
But they're still going in the wrong direction. So what that means is in order to get growth, we're not going to be doing it by making more babies. We're going to be doing it by making each baby more productive. And the question is, how do we do that? So there are a few things that we think about when we're thinking about productivity. The first one, of course, is human capital, technology. We have to make sure that we have the kinds of advances in our economy that allow things to grow. The second would be have a tax system that is both sensible and equitable. We're moving in that direction. Actually, the tax reform bill, which I thought was a good one, moved in the direction by reducing the taxes on capital. That's the most important thing you can do in terms of economic growth.
Mm-hmm.
Regulatory system, we want to have sensible regulation. That doesn't mean no regulation, but it means a cost-benefit approach to regulation.
Mm-hmm.
And then finally, and this is important, really important over the long haul, is the budget. If you look out a couple of decades, use anybody's numbers, the administration's numbers, Congressional Budget Office numbers, private numbers, we're looking at a budget that is going to be about 1.5 times what it is today.
Right.
In order to finance that, we're going to have to either raise taxes or borrow like crazy, both of which are going to be detrimental to the economy. And so in the long haul, we've got to get our budget situation under control or we're going to be in big trouble. And the long haul is already starting to happen.
Mm-hmm. Let's backtrack a second to technology. Are we leaders in technology right now?
We are leaders. We still spend the most on technological innovation. R&D spending in the United States is greater than anybody else in the world, but we're also the largest economy in the world.
Right.
So if you look at it as a proportion of our GDP, we're not the leader. The leaders are places like Israel and Korea, again, which is not a surprise to you. If you think of their economies mm-hmm. and the kind of technology they've had, it's no surprise that they're investing more in technological change, R&D, than we are. On the human capital side, which is also the important thing, we have some problems. We're great in terms of college, university education, tertiary education. We lead the world, no question about it. The best universities in the world are in the United States, and that's great. We happen to be sitting in one of them. But our K-12 system is not as good as some others in the world. We know that. We lag way behind, especially given the income that we have, the per capita GDP. We don't look good in that respect, and we have to get that moving. That's a key source of our technological change. So we've got a lot of work to do on that front.
When you reference to a lagging education system, what are you referencing, STEM?
STEM is important, but it's not only STEM. It's really by any number. If you look at there are many tests that rate our students relative to others in the world. They have all these acronyms, PISA, TIMSS, all kinds of things that people look at.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at our scores relative to others, we just don't do as well. There are countries like Finland, if you look mm-hmm. at parts of China like Shanghai, Korea, other countries do way better in that respect, not only in math, certainly in math, but not only in math, also in other skills as well, science, even literature, they do better. And the question is, you know, what are we going to do to remedy that? I think the big issue that faces us right now is our K-12 system, in some sense, it suffers from our optimism. That sounds a little crazy. But one of the things that Americans think about is that everybody can succeed. And so we don't want to give up on anybody. And as a result, we tend to put our students through academic programs that at some point become not of very much use to them when they get into the job market. So, for example, take a kid who is in 10th grade and not doing all that well in high school, and you say, yeah, but, you know, there's still a chance that person might make it to college. So what do? We try to get that person to Algebra 1 by the time he or she is a senior. You know, if he doesn't go to college, what's he going to do with Algebra 1? He has no labor market skills.
Right.
If you compare that to the German-speaking parts of Europe, Germany, Switzerland, Austria in particular, they're great in terms of vocational training. By the way, vocational does not necessarily mean manufacturing or technical jobs like plumbing or electricians. It's also service jobs. And they just do a much better job at that. And if you look at their graduates, they come out with higher productivity and also higher wages. So we might be better off looking at their pattern and at least moving a bit in that direction.
You mentioned the tax cuts and deregulation efforts, and our Hoover colleagues have written a lot about this. I don't see this happening in Washington a second time unless the president's reelected and he comes back in the Republican Congress. Otherwise, it's hard to see Democrats in either chamber wanting to work with him on this. But as you look at what Trump did in his first term on taxes and deregulation, is that a bite out of the apple? And if there is such a thing as a tax cut deregulation 2.0, what would you like to see in it?
Well, I would say that the most important thing to do is to raise enough revenue to fund the government, but do it in the most efficient way. So there's no magic to just cutting taxes. It's not like if you cut taxes, growth takes off. If you cut taxes and you don't cut spending, you still have the same problem. You're going to have to finance that somehow. So either you borrow, which means taxes in the future, or you tax right now, and both of those things are going to slow down the economy. So again, the 2.0 that I would say would really be more on the spending side. It wouldn't be so much on the tax side. I think we've moved about as far as we can possibly move in terms of taxes. President and his people did a good job in terms of reducing taxes on capital, which to my mind is the most important thing you can do to grow an economy by enhancing efficiency. But again, we got to get something on the spending side. That's easier said than done. No one, neither Republicans nor Democrats, have done a good job of holding down spending.
I hate to be a cynic about the budget, but this is a president who does not have an interest in entitlement reform. Right. Paul Ryan, at one point the House Speaker, a man very serious about entitlement reform and spending, the system chewed him up and spat him out.
Yeah.
How do you see Congress and this president going about doing something about the budget, absent facing a crisis where they have to do it?
Well, I think I was going to make the last point that you made. Absent facing a crisis is pretty tough. So if you think about the most significant steps we took, it'd probably be with respect to Social Security reform a couple of decades ago when we did make some significant changes. Even then, we pushed things out 20 years, you know, and said, all right, well, these things aren't going to take effect in terms of delaying the age of entitlement and so forth. But it did take a crisis to do it. Everybody was worried that the Social Security Fund was going to go bankrupt, and that's what necessitated the change. Tough to say, but that seems to be the way governments work. You know, you see a city government that's on the verge of bankruptcy, and that's essentially what gets it to clean up its act. That may have to happen at the federal level. There are things we could do. I mean, I certainly can think of things that we could do that would be sensible, like putting caps on the growth in spending without specifying how those caps would be implemented. So if we did it in a kind of a general way and said, look, let's agree that we're not going to increase spending by more than, say, X percent of the inflation rate or something like that, or even less than the inflation rate, that might be something that both sides could agree on conceptually. When it gets down to how do we do that, they'd have to fight it out. But at least conceptually, that might be something that we could do. Again, I'm not optimistic. No one gains from those kinds of proposals. It takes a guy like Paul Ryan, who's a real in-the-weeds kind of nerd legislator. He was great at that. You need someone who has not only that intellect and that background, but also has the political ability to get himself elected. If he does that, then that kind of person could do it.
Let's close out with a word that I imagine comes up every time you give a speech. Somebody in the audience asks it, and that's the R word, recession.
Yeah.
The party out of power will not publicly wish for this to happen,
right?
But in their heart of hearts, They'd like to see an economic downturn. Easiest way to kick a man out of office. We saw this happen with Bush 41. You worked in a White House the second term of the Bush 43 administration where you were stuck with the Great Recession.
Right.
2006, 2007, 2008. Without trotting out a crystal ball here, as I know predictions are what they are, I've made a lot of bad predictions in 2016 myself. But when we talk about the recession, people start ramping up this talk. When we have weeks like this, a lot of henny-penny forecasting goes out. What is, in your estimation, though, the likelihood of a recession? Are we warming up to recession? Do you think a recession is likely in the next year?
I would say it's not likely, but it's much more likely than it was a year ago. Mm-hmm. So, and the reason is kind of an obvious one. As you get close to the peak, and we talked at the early part of this discussion about the labor market,
right.
We're close to the peak of the labor market. We're also have pretty high growth rates compared to our recent historic past. It's much tougher to push out the frontier than it is to catch up. So when you're in a recovery phase, like was occurring in 2010, 11, 12, there's a lot of slack resources. It's easy to get the economy going again. That sounds a little counterintuitive, but that's the easiest time to do it. When you're at the top, it's hard to stay at the top. The only thing that can basically happen is you can continue as you were, or you can go down. There's really very little other than that. So the probability of going into recession is higher now than it was before. Again, I gave you the best indicator, which I think is the market. The market is still saying 1 to 1.5% growth for next year. That's not what it was saying a little while ago. You mentioned volatility. You want to be a little careful about that because mm-hmm. These things change, unfortunately, from week to week right now. But I would say the market is not forecasting a recession. So I wouldn't say it's over 50%, but I would say it's higher than it was a year ago. And so if I were a betting man, I'd bet on slow but continued positive growth.
Okay, so let's close out. Today is August the 14th. For now, at least, you're willing to say the economy is strong, yes or no?
I would say the economy is strong, but it's still what we should be focusing on right now is the long run rather than the short run, and that's there's a simple reason for that. Policymakers are much better at clearing a path for a rapid economic growth in the future than they are for dealing with current little cyclical blips up or down. Even the Fed is not particularly good at doing that. If you look at the Fed's policies and how long it takes for those to play out, it takes about a year, actually, for those to play out. So we're not very good at the short run. We're good at the long run. That's what we should be focusing on. We should be focusing on the kind of policies that will contribute to long-term growth and just hope that the short run is favorable and that the gods are in our favor.
Okay. Ed Lazier, enjoy the conversation. Thanks for coming down off the mountain.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. In this podcast, the President's economic policies. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us and tell your friends all about us. You can find the Hoover Institution online at www.hoover.org. While you're there, sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Hoover Fellows, including Eddie Lazier, straight to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is @HooverInst. Dr. Edward Lazier has a page at Hoover.org, and he also has a page at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, and the web address for Stanford GSB is gsb.stanford.edu. Anything else I need to mention on your behalf?
I think that's about it.
For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. Thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on iTunes, iTunes U, Stitcher, and SoundCloud. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.